that would be James Grant, Dave Linder, Logan Wild Gotchall Firm, and Andrew Pollard from Exact amount of these leftover charges. And at the Kenya side, that resulted immediately.
in a blizzard of activity. Exxon's second lead attendant, Mr. Fitzpatrick, reported to his superior at Exxon, Mr. Hendrick, that the invoice, quote, implied the Saudi payment to Union Carbide was much less than the Kenyan payment to Saudi, close quote. And by July 1994, Exxon, in the 20 years of the Kenyan board, had discussed the payment differential, and Hendrick, an Exxon executive, wrote in a note that there was, quote, reason to believe that Kenya pays about $16 more per year than it should, close quote. And after all this, Exxon chose, apparently for business reasons, not to pursue them. Now, despite this, and the other evidence in our brief showing that it was inquiry notice, the jury was not permitted to consider the statute of limitations by reason of the trial court's oral pretrial summary judgment ruling. That, as a matter of law, there was no applicable statute of limitations. And that is simply error.
Mr. Sparks, can you refresh? Your client was the plaintiff below, right?
Client was the plaintiff below seeking declaratory relief that it was not liable on these overcharge claims.
Yeah, that's what I don't really get, which is, I understand the policy purpose behind our borrowing statute, but it really doesn't make sense to me. You haven't challenged in your brief the notion that under Saudi, if this case had proceeded in Saudi Arabia, there really isn't a statute of limitations. Your client chooses and seeks out Delaware as a forum and sue somebody to get a declaration of non-liability. And then, instead of being willing to fight that on the substantive ground, you say, the reason we're not liable is because Delaware's statute of limitations has run.
We did plead in the declaratory judgment complaint the statute. And we're prepared.
But tell me the policy says, because none of the relevant conduct here occurred to Delaware. Your client simply chose Delaware as the forum to have this battle. And then says, we don't win on the substance. We win because the Delaware borrowing statute applies, and the shorter of the limitation period is Delaware, where nothing occurred, and therefore we win on technical grounds. I just don't understand why that isn't either an improper use of the declaratory judgment procedure or simply an implicit but very obvious waiver of the borrowing statute's protections.
Number one, we didn't select this form for any reason other than the fact that among foreign in the United States, this was the only one where you could be sure you get these two subsidiaries. They weren't present in, for example, New Jersey action. These are two Delaware corporations. We can sue them and get jurisdiction over them. Number two, fully understood and understand that this would not preclude a decision on the borrowing statute and the statute of limitations grounds would not preclude the other side from going and suing in Saudi Arabia.
So you sued in Delaware to get a declaration that you couldn't be sued in Delaware?
And to get a determination on inquiry notice, which would be collateral estoppel in any other jurisdiction. May or may not, depending on the length of the statute of limitations in another jurisdiction, result in the same result as Delaware. And we also, we sued in one of our counts was declaratory judgment that is barred by the statute of limitations. We also sued on substance, so if we had not prevailed for whatever reason on the statute of limitations, the merits would have also been litigated here. In fact, they were, as we see. We submitted the trial court's decision is contrary to any number of both statutory mandates and case law mandates. The last sentence of the borrowing statute, section 8121, provides that where in cause of action proves in favor of a person who is a resident of the state, that Delaware's limitation period shall apply. ECAIN are Delaware residents. In Rosman versus FDIC, this court held that the last sentence of the statute means what it says, quote, the Delaware statute of limitations must apply. And as this court stated in PAC versus Beach Aircraft, and as reflected in the first sentence of 8121 itself, the clear purpose of 8121 and borrowing statute generally is only to shorten the statute of limitations, applicable actions arising in foreign jurisdictions, not to lengthen it. Notwithstanding that, the trial court ruled, as Vice Chancellor Stryan just observed, that the Delaware law required application of what should be to be a longer internal Saudi limitations period. And simply put, there's no basis in law contradicts those instances of 81-21, directly contradicts Crosby, contradicts the court's demand and pact of 81-21 that designed to shorten the time limit, not to extend it, and broke into the equation establishing the law of judgment in common law that property rights are eternal to the New Jersey wrongful death issue, or statute that was at issue in the pact case, which not only involved a shorter limitations rather than a longer implementation period, but also involved a statute with a building condition destroying the statutory cause of action itself if not commenced within a particular time. In other words, the PAC case is a case where the cause of action, by virtue of the action of the New Jersey legislature saying we're creating something that doesn't exist in common law, but we're putting a two-year limit on it, it was dead on arrival before it got here. And that had absolutely no application to the facts.
Mr. Spurs, help us focus for a minute. There were really two components of the trial court's ruling on the statute of limitations issue. The first was that to the extent there's a cause of action under Saudi law, there is no statute of limitations. And the second was that the borrowing statute as a policy matter should not apply in this case. I gather it's only the second ruling that's a concern to you.
It's a second ruling that's a concern, and it is in fact vis-a-vis the trial court as a super legislature.
But there's a lot of talk in the briefs about whether the court should or shouldn't have determined that there's an eternal statute of limitations or no statute of limitations, but that's all irrelevant, isn't it? Because even if there is no statute of limitations, if your construction of the borrowing statute is correct, in fact, the claim is borrowed.
Right.
So and it's only the latter determination that's of relevance here, is that right?
That's right. It's the latter determination that the refusal to apply the last sentence of the borrowing statute in the circumstance where the legislature has said it and has applied it.
Mr. Spartan, how do you deal with the fact that the borrowing statute's framework says that where a cause of action arises outside the state, an action cannot be brought in the court of the state?
You're referring to Section 8117.
Who brought the action here?
We brought the action when the borrowing statute is key to the cause of action to the president. And as we pointed out in the briefs, 8117 has no application here. Under this court's decision, Hurwitz versus Adams, which is a 1959 decision, totally 8117 applies only if a person is not subject to personal or other service to compel his appearance. Sovereign has at all times under 1608B of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act been subject to service and process. So
that's an argument that your side made for the first time in the time period, is that right?
It was not a basis for the court's ruling below.
Is that right?
Excuse me?
Did your side raise the argument under the FSIA for the first time in the reply?
Absolutely.
So we have essentially a one-sided argument with no ability of the other side to test whether or not, in fact, your client could be served under that statute.
No, the other side fully briefed 8117 in their answer brief, and we responded to them before. And they raised it and characterized it as an additional grounds for affirmance.
And in their answering brief, they pointed out that your side, knowing that that was an issue below, made no reference to it, and that they were concerned that they would be sending back in the reply brief.
We had no way of knowing it would be an issue on appeal. It wasn't reached by the court below. In fact, no one would have thought that if the court below would have thought it had any merit, it would have reached it first because it would have disposed of the statute of limitations issue without having to struggle as to whether it would attack and more aggressively the decisions. Because the court looked at it, obviously thought it was a moment because it's very simply answered. The other side comes in and raises it as an additional grounds for affirmance in their answer brief, and we responded in our reply.
If 8117 applies, then the statute is told that there is no more statute of limitations argument.
If 8117 were to apply, we were not to have been subject at all times to 2017. What applies? That's what.
And if your side were to prevail on the limitations argument, which is couched as an affirmative claim in this lawsuit, what would be the import of it? That it would be a final judgment that the other side would not be entitled to sue in Delaware if they chose to do it, but would be free to sue someplace else?
It would be free to sue someplace else. We would certainly sue with respect to any term issues with respect to inquiry notice on collateral estoppel basis to export that to whatever jurisdiction it might be appropriate to do so. And if they're right, there's no terminal. There's no statute of limitations in Saudi Arabia, you have no application there. And in connection with some other state, it would depend on how long the other state's statute of limitations was. If they had a 3-year statute, we would certainly argue that there was collateral estoppel on any issue having to do with inquiry notice in that other state, that they could still seek to bring their subject to whatever other defenses we might have.
Mr. Schwartz, I just, because this might be the, only one that's important to it. To me, I don't understand your answer about the first sentence of Section 81.1, the borrowing statute. It says, where a cause of action arises outside of the state, an action cannot be brought in a court of the state to enforce such cause of action after the expiration of whichever issue order, dot, dot, dot. Your client brought the action, not your opponent. So why is it just, there's the logical inference that the borrowing statute wasn't intended to provide opportunistic gains for declaratory judgment plaintiffs seeking declarations of non-liability.
Because first, the cause of action accrued to ExxonMobil. And that's governed by the last sentence.
But that's the sentence. Tell me, what the meaning of the first sentence is then?
The meaning of the first sentence has no direct application in these circumstances, but if you were to give application to the next sentence, it's clear that it deals with a shorter statute of limitations, either a warning.
So it's simply the second sentence that you believe applies?
Yes. Unless you have other questions, I'd like to turn to the second point. And that is that it's solemn evidence. As we point out in the brief, there were a number of critical evidentiary rulings, and they were all exacerbated by the difficulty of trying the case based on the recollections of people. Some dead, some alive, and a lot of faded memories from 20 years ago. But the most crucial error of this sort was the rule prohibiting Mr. Bin Salman, Sabiq's chief negotiator of this new agreement, from testifying that he had personally told his counterparts at ExxonMobil during the negotiation that Sabiq would receive a margin technology. And that testimony was accepted by the jury, would have regretted that of Mr. Murphy. If only ExxonMobil had to recall the statement by Sabiq during the negotiations, today would be a pass-through. And would belie ExxonMobil's assertions to the jury that the so-called most common principle applied to the technology required to manufacture polyethylene, and that Sabiq was, to use their words, secretly cheating his partners. Mr. Bin Salman is a former employee of Sabiq, not in Sabiq's control, who currently sits in the South Pacific of the U.S. Senate. Very difficult for us to reach, difficult for the other side to reach. And the substance of his prospective testimony on this point was made known to ExxonMobil in a declaration served on him as soon as Sabiq learned it, 4 months before trial. In short, there was no unfair surprise. Nevertheless, the trial court concluded his testimony as a form of discovery sanction based upon the theory that it was inconsistent with Sabiq's prior discovery responses. And that was wrong both as a matter of fact and law. First, in prior discovery, Sabiq, in his response to request for admission under 1017 of the other side's appendix, and his witnesses in their 36 depositions had merely said truthfully, and before anyone learned of Bin Salman's specific testimony, that they did not know whether any Sabiq employee had told ExxonMobil that Sabiq was receiving a margin. As a legal matter, under Chancellor Allen's decision in Carlson versus Beatrice, which is the only Delaware case on point, a corporate entity is not required to inquire former employees from the paragraph 36 designated.
Mr. Sparks, just wanted to be courteous enough to remind you that you have time for rebuttal that you've reserved. You can use your time now or continue to reserve it.
I think I'll go on for a few minutes. Remarkably, the post-trial ruling in front of the Pew team to acknowledge the existence of Carlson. Under Carlson, nothing cited the legitimacy of matters to the legal position on the discovery rules requiring the revelation of public assumption of witness preclusion. A civil death penalty, as Chief Justice Steele, back at his prior life on the Court of Chancery, mentioned in the tenure of this criminal case. We submit that's a clear abuse of discretion requires reversal. The last point I want to touch with and say will not get to the license agreement point, it does not appear, but we'll get to the briefs, is Wilson. Under Saudi law, given the Islamic prohibition on the payment of interest, the only damage awardable in breach of contract is a return of the property taken. However, under the tort of Wilson, enhanced damages are theoretically awardable in non-contract cases in unusual and compelling circumstances. The court's ruling on Wilson was the product of three separate errors. Both Sadek and the court's appointed expert opined that Wilson is an overtaken property that not only deprives the plaintiff of property, but also shames or dishonors the plaintiff because he or his neighbors know about it. He doesn't know about it personally what happened, but his neighbors know about it. And it shames him because he's powerless to stop it. The very reason that it's more severe is because of this shame effect. And contrary to the views of the majority of Saudi law experts and most importantly Wilson, the trial court adopted the erroneous view of Exxon's expert that secret taking could give rise to Wilson, apparently failing to recognize that the term bar or farming, which all the experts agree is part of the definition in the Hammadi text, excludes secret techniques, and Wilson explains this at 712 and elsewhere.
Mr. Charles, what do we have to do with the ruling of the court below? I'm reading from page number 54 of your opening brief. It says, contrary to the implication of Sadek's briefing on this issue, the reality is that one cannot simply consult the statute book or a case reporter to find the elements of or damages available for the Saudi court order. To illustrate the extreme difficulty of discerning and interpreting Saudi law, the court notes that none of the Saudi law experts who testified agree on the proper elements of the investigation.
Your Honor, I'm going to hand up something that may help answer that. I'm going to hand this to the court. This is a supplemental appendix to the testimony, which is a lot more to the other side. This is a lot there, expert testimony. That he didn't know whether Saudi law had fallen since 870 AD in terms of the definition was a or from the 17th century. Both of the other experts testified that the modern Saudi definition of quar excludes a taking. Notwithstanding that, the trial court below relied solely on the ancient text, contrary to what Rule 44.1 says, which is to non-existing law. In the Islamic system, they don't have, as you hear here, they don't have a system of precedence like we do where they look at case law. But they do read these ancient texts and put present-day meaning on the terms of either Mr. Halak, who I recognize that in one of his statements in his deposition. Here the error was that the court got locked into the 870 AD, followed a lot in Warren Perone. Also ignored Mr. Volvo and the ancient text in terms of the color of writing point, which says that if you have any color of writing, it's not Wilson. Therefore, you can't really have Wilson in a contract circumstance if you have a color of the claim. And she ruled that the other side's position on the contract was ambiguous, and this court has already ruled in the cases cited in our papers that. She has said that reasonableness means that there's at least color for all of those reasons. The Wilson decision was inappropriate. Also, Cimarron's and also federal due process make it clear that if you're going to give an instruction to a jury on something such as enhanced damages or any other point, you have to give them some guidance. And all this instruction said was, you may or may not award, in fact, $324 million. I challenge your honor to read the last two post-trial opinions of that. You cannot read those and leave with any confidence that this Blissett matter was handled in a way that was appropriate vis-a-vis this jury. It was simply given to the jury with no guidance, and the court sort of throws up its hands indeed on the definition of Blissett. I think if you go back to the record, as I am trying to do, and focus on the Halak testimony that I just mentioned, you will see that was there. I don't know if this means I can hold my rebuttal time or if it means that I just threw that my 19 minutes.
What it means is you made my first operation of the clock very simple by using all your time and your equipment.
All right, well, I've turned the podium over.
Intended to apply in a circumstance where a
mid-year and tried to get a longer statute of limitations. I think that was the intent, and that was what was meant. In the second sense, I think that
the clause means where a cause of action arises outside of the state, an action cannot be brought in court of the state to enforce blah blah blah.
Yes.
But that introductory language sets the stage for the remainder of the
statute.
You have a cause of action arising out of the state and an action to enforce that cause of action that's brought affirmatively, then 8121 doesn't apply.
I believe that is the intent of the statute. And I think that that's supplemented by the fact that if you look at how PAC ultimately, one of the things we were thinking about this, whether or not, one of the arguments that Sopcich made over and over again, well, the whole idea was you want to get a shorter statute of limitations. Well, if you think about the PAC case, I don't think there's any doubt that if the statute in New Jersey had been 10 years instead of 2, if it was longer, the PAC case would have applied to the New Jersey statute because it was part of the substantive law of New Jersey. It wasn't a question of taking and choosing the shorter versus the longer. It was a question in that case of what was the substantive law, what is intertwined with the claim. If you're doing a conflict of laws analysis and New Jersey law in that case applied, you would apply all of it, not just part of it. One of the things that we found of interest, and I think it's of interest here, as we were thinking about this and preparing, is that one of the issues, and Mr. Sparks mentioned this in this case, is whether or not we can get interest on our claim. And under Saudi law, you're not entitled to interest. And so therefore, we didn't get interest. But the argument came up during the course of the case as to whether or not, for public policy reasons, since we were Delaware corporations, we should be entitled to get interest. And the Saudi side argued vividly that no, that was part of the substantive law of Saudi Arabia, and we were not allowed to pick and choose which parts of the law that they like and which parts of the law they don't like. Well, this is a very unique circumstance with Sopcich now seeking to pick that part that they like in Delaware and not that part that they don't like.
Do I take it, Mr. Quinn, that as far as your side is concerned, the limitations issue can be disposed of based on PAC's construction of the second sentence of the statute?
That, yes, Your Honor, I believe
in that regard to public policy.
Yes, I think that this court in the PAC circumstance, well, in a sense, the PAC is looking at public policy by saying that that they're not going to apply a rigidly barred statute in a certain circumstance where a Delaware resident who is still not foreign cause of action, rather than look at the cause of action where it occurred and make the determination as to which statute appropriately should apply. And I think that also happens in the Simone case. And there's several other cases that we cite in the brief where the PAC rationale is, in fact, utilized and brings in a foreign statute. Now, in addition, with regard to 8117, putting aside the fact that they didn't raise it in their brief, and they certainly could have because they did it raised below, the reality is that reading that statute under any circumstances is an independent basis for tolling statute of limitations. So I have taken the position in New Jersey and all along, until most recently, that in fact they cannot be sued under the FSIA until they filed a lawsuit in Delaware. Because it wasn't until they filed a lawsuit in Delaware that, in fact, under the language of 8117, they had come into the state. That statute doesn't simply mean if there's some way I can nail a nail or do some kind of service process, that's all you need to do. It has to be processed that's meaningful. If you look at the Brosnan case and the Petriolo Mexicana case, both of those cases say that the service has to be such that you can get in personam jurisdiction, you can get a judgment that's enforceable in Delaware, not simply that you send somebody something in the mail and they may or may not show up. 8117 applies here. It applies to Sabbath. It applies to Sabbath specifically because they took the position throughout the Jersey case and in this case that they were not subject to being served and therefore getting jurisdiction over them until they in fact came into Delaware.
Is your point that Sabbath is judicially stopped?
It is, given the prior position. Now,
for a moment with regard to the issue of Mr. Bitten's Alamont and whether or not that was error. First of all, as I understand it, under the this circumstance, when we're talking about a matter of evidence, the other side has a burden of showing that there was significant prejudice here. Now, you have to step back and, having lived through this, understand what actually happened with Mr. Bitten's Alamont. What actually happened was, they, and the record is clear, we cited all this in the brief. For months, they stonewalled us about this issue, and they told us that in their 36 depositions, in request to admit, and in other depositions, that they had no knowledge that, in fact, anybody had ever told us about an increase or difference with regard to what they called the margin. And finally, after all the survey was closed, there was no depositions available. And in response to our motion for summary judgment on the contract issue, they, in fact, came up with a Solomon declaration which said he did now remember that he had, in fact, told a variety of dead people that there was, in fact, a margin.
Were they dead then?
I think two of the three of them were already dead.
That's not the only
thing. Oh, sounds like that. And so we obviously took the position that this was improper. But I think the most telling part of this whole story and why there's no substantial prejudice, and this is the part I was a little surprised at, my colleague, Mr. Sparks, had forgotten, but Mr. Solomon did in fact testify. He testified a whole bunch of things. One of the things he actually testified to was with regard to the second level I hate to use the word cheating, it seems so unfair, but that's what happened. When they yielded us with regard to the releases back in 87, and they increased the actual quote margin, I asked him on the witness stand, well, did you tell anybody about this? And on the witness stand, he said, no, it was none of their business. In the deposition that he said that he gave 2 days before he got on the witness stand, this is what he said in the answer to a question and answer. When asked the deposition, this is in footnote 35 of the brief, only days before his trial testimony, whether he, quote, ever told anyone from Mobil or from Exxon about Solomon's expected margin, close quote, Bitten, Solomon, conceded, quote, we never talked about the margin. So it's really hard to see under those circumstances that there was any significant prejudice that would require a reversal of a jury verdict. Particularly in light of the fact the jury got to see Mr. Solomon and see him testify and see him actually tell all of us that it was the fact that they were overcharging us was quote unquote business. Now,
but is it not the case that there were other witnesses whose testimony arose after the discovery deadline who were allowed to testify from on your side? I believe your friend asserted that in the breach.
I don't recall that happening. I may be misremembering, but I believe when the discovery ended, that there may have been some depositions that were taken after that because there was an agreement that if you were going to, in fact, that's why we don't tell them on deposition, that if you're going to call somebody that otherwise had not been deposed prior to trial, you could depose them prior to trial. But other than that, I don't believe there was any.
Was this gentleman, rather than risk mispronouncing his name off the phone, this gentleman, was he the 30B6 witness on this issue?
No, it was somebody else who was the 30B6 witness, but a fellow by the name of Dr. Pye. But Dr. Pye, prior to giving his final 30B6 testimony on this issue, spoke to Ben Solomon for 8 hours. And we asked Dr. Pye in his deposition, my colleague, Mr. Lindsay, whether or not this issue had ever come up, we had handwritten notes.
When your friend said that this gentleman was the 30B6 witness with this particular issue, Mr. Pye was for other issues, and you didn't bother to take his 30B6 deposition in that capacity, that's just not correct.
That is not correct. He, the Dr. Pott wasn't the 30B6 witness on the issue of what was told to Exxon and Mobil. Mr. Ben Salamat didn't show up on the scene other than having a meeting with Dr. Pott, so Dr. Pott could give his 30B6 testimony. He didn't show up on the scene until he gets his affidavit after all discovery report. Which is why I believe that the Superior Court felt that there was a certain amount of sandbagging that was going on, at least by stopping. And I'm not in any way impugning the lawyer, but simply saying that I think that there were serious issues that the court felt strongly about. It was put Exxon in a position where we couldn't rebut Ben Salamat, one of the witnesses who they claimed, at least actually two of the witnesses, I believe, who they claimed he said that were dead. But a third one was in. Was out of the country, and we simply were not able to get his deposition to rebut the testimony. Now, let me talk for a moment, if I could, on the issue of, and I think maybe we refer to it as usurpation rather than usurpation, because here I think the Saad has gone a long way to try to undermine the incredible work that was done by the Superior Court in trying to come up with what exactly was the right element with regard to usurpation. And if you go back and you look at all the decisions by Judge Jordan in this regard, and you look at all of the, there were 12 expert reports, including expert reports put in by Saad after the verdict, that were hundreds of pages of testimony on these issues. Everyone agreed, all three of the experts agreed on a few basic things. One, that the Hanbali school was the school was the actual law to be applied in Saudi Arabia. They all agreed to that. They also all agreed that with regard to the issue of whether or not you had to have open and notorious or jar or jaran, which was the term in the Sharia law, all of them agreed that the Hanbali school did not require that. All of them, Wolfson, Vogel, and Salah. So when particularly Vogel, who Judge Jordan hasn't seen him testify, determined that it was basically more of an advocate than an expert, his testimony kept changing. But where Vogel then did was go outside the applicable law. It was like, as the analogy somebody used was, it's as if the U.S. law applies it, you go to France to see what they do. And in trying to import concepts from other schools in the Sharia law, they simply didn't apply. And what, after going through and struggling through all the testimony and all the expert reports, what Judge Jordan did was use, as the term is, her ishtihad. That is, her broad discretion, which you are allowed to do under the Saudi law, and everybody agreed to it. Wolfson agreed to it, Vogel agreed to it, Halak, all the experts agreed that that is precisely what a judge sitting in as a Saudi judge would do in order to come together. One of the most interesting parts of all this, and we all learned a lot about Saudi law, one of the most interesting parts about it was, and I think Vogel himself testified to it, their guy, that oftentimes the same judges on the same facts will in fact come out with different results. And just the nature of having a system that has no precedent, and it's the system that in fact exists under the Sharia law. Therefore, and one other point on this issue of open and notorious, I asked Mr. Vogel during his deposition, the following question, it's in the group. I said, look, if I go out to Brazil, and you come in and take my horse, and I'm in Brazil for a couple of years, and you go and take my horse, I have no idea you've taken my horse. And perhaps other people know, perhaps they don't, but I don't. Wouldn't that be usurpation? Wouldn't that be robbery? He thought for a moment and said, yes. Well, under those circumstances, it's clear that you don't have to have knowledge. And he also conceded in essence that it was not necessary to be, quote, open and notorious. And in Wolf, that, in fact, under the Hunt-Wallace rule, you don't need open notorious. Now, Mr. And I know this is really arcane stuff, but Mr. Suarez raised it. Mr. Suarez said, well, but in the Hanbali rules, there's a time that's called the law. And that's true. But what Mr. Wolfson, the independent, testified to, along with Palazzo, that that in the Hanbali rules simply means without consent. Nothing, and here clearly, that was satisfied. The bottom line, I think, is that, and I think we've cited cases to this effect, that under these circumstances, particularly where the credibility of experts were involved, well, obviously your review is a de novo review. We believe, should give deference to the trial court who heard all the evidence, listened to the experts, saw them be cross-examined, read through the deposition, appointed her own expert. I've tried all these cases. I've never seen a more thorough, analytical job done by any judge to try to come to the right result. And in fact, one of the most interesting things asked of all the experts is, in the end, when you are exercising your ishtihad, what is it that a Saudi judge is supposed to do? And I believe from the witness stand, Mr. Wolfson said, he or she is trying to do the right thing in the circumstances. I've always agreed with that philosophy. It's a different concept, but that, in fact, is what happened here. What Judge Jurgen did is she took a look at all of the different underlying reports, and there was an endless amount of discussion, very technical. There was a lot of talk about goats and sheep and horses, because, in fact, in the text that maps in Sharia law, those are the kinds of examples that are used.
Well, what do you do with the fact that, like, embezzlement, I thought all the experts concluded something like embezzlement would not qualify as this tort, and that your expert, no one was able to cite any example close to this case where this serious tort was used.
Well, the latter, Your Honor, because there is no stare decisis, and therefore there's no place to go close to these things. And whether or not in a particular circumstance in the 17th century or the 18th century something similar like this occurred, none of us will ever know. And what the judge decided is that with regard to, for example, when Mr. Wolfson went to the king and he had discussions with lawyers, and I think the judge didn't want to actually tell his identity, she decided that that wasn't a proper study of what we're supposed to do in terms of actually analyzing the Saudi law. Rather, you have to go back to the original text and the original Saudi thinkers and look at what they say the elements are. And what she determined based on looking at those writings and the analysis of those writings by all the experts, that in fact the elements of usurpation with those that she charged the jury with.
What about the question about lack of standards for determining whether to award enhanced damages?
Your Honor, I think that's a very good question, because I think that it's a canvas issue. This was not a question of enhanced damages. What I mean by that is under, and all of the experts agree that under the tort of usurpation, you were entitled to get, not only, I'll use the analogy that are used, you're entitled to get back not only your goat, but the baby goat. And by that I mean the very specific and vocal of all people actually said this, that the Hanbali school is extraordinarily tough about making sure that you get back not only your money, but any profits earned with regard to your money. So there were standards, and those were the standards that were set down under the Saudi law, to which every side agreed, and that's how the jury was charged on the issue. What's interesting here...
One of the jurors said that it's told that you may award the additional damages.
That's correct. And you may or may not.
Well, if it's as you say, then the jury should have been instructed, if you find Part A, you shall award the additional damages.
No, because I think regard to usurpation, that they had to find that was done blatantly and recklessly. Something that frankly probably raised the bar above what was necessary under the unbalanced rule with regard to usurpation. I believe that the charges that Judge Jury gave in these instances were clear, they weren't misleading in any way, and I think the jury understood what they were supposed to do. One of the things that I think is important to understand, we were not allowed to even mention this issue until all of the evidence was in. Because the judge wanted to make a determination herself that we had, in fact, reached of an appropriate burden of proof that would allow this issue of the usurpation to go to the jury. Thank you.
I will quibble about whether I spent your 8 seconds discussing the clock or not. You may have 8 seconds. That's fine.
One, not all day.
Thank you very much for an excellent argument, Bruce.
Thank you.